trust and obey, for there's no other way. You know the hymn, and no, I'm not going to sing it. We're still trying to reach new listeners here at the TC Podcast, and trust me, that would only drive people away. I'm Josh Larson. On today's episode, we're going to consider the heart of that hymn. What does it mean to trust God and obey, especially when times are tough or the path ahead is scary? Now, because there's no such thing as secular, it turns out the new Disney Pixar film, Onward, includes a moving scene that deals with this very idea. Abby Olchesi and I will break that down for you, and maybe, because this seems inevitable whenever Pixar comes up, maybe we'll talk about where we think Onward ranks among the studio's beloved films. Trust is also a crucial component for the competitive college cheer squad featured in Netflix's documentary series, Cheer. On a cheer team like this, athletes allow themselves to be tossed high into the air, trusting that their teammates will catch them. Is that also a model for the biblical notion of trust? J.R. Forresteros and I will discuss. Before we head to Texas for that, though, it's off to New Mushroom Town, the suburban fantasy world of Onward. Abby Olchesi is joining me for the exciting occasion of a new Pixar film. Now, Abby, do these still feel like events for you, or has the glow of Pixar somewhat faded in recent years?
I think it kind of depends. So, like, the release of Toy Story 4 last year felt like an event because it was something that I had a really strong connection to. And occasionally, stuff like Inside Out also feels like an event where it's like something that's really exciting and new. So usually if it's within like the Pete Docter, Andrew Stanton kind of pantheon, then I tend to get a little more excited. And Brad Bird as well. That's always worth a visit.
Yeah, you can definitely at this point start tracing some directors who have a great track record. And as you said, I'm with you. They've made some really good sequels, some amazing sequels, but I do get excited when there's an original concept coming out of Pixar, and that's the case here. So maybe you can set the story up a little bit for us, Abby, with Onward, which is an original one this time.
Yeah. So the story of Onward is, it kind of takes place in a fantasy realm where magic was once... like it was sort of like a D&D kind of a situation where magic was everywhere and there were magical creatures. And now in the modern world, there are still magical creatures, but everybody uses the same kind of technology that we do. So like the advent of electricity is a thing. And like for all intents and purposes, everything in that world looks like ours, except for the characters. They look different. And it follows the story of two brothers who are elves, Ian and Barley. Barley's the older one. Ian is the younger one, who's kind of our protagonist. And on Ian's 16th birthday, they receive a letter from their dad, who passed away when Ian was before Ian was born. And it's kind of a rejuvenation spell. They can bring him back for one day if they use the instructions that he provided them. And so the rest of the movie is them trying to get the ingredients they need in order to actually do the spell, and Ian kind of learning that he has magical abilities, and his brother, Barley, who's a big-time magic and history nerd of their world but doesn't have those abilities, trying to impart his knowledge to him and make him a more confident wizard.
Yeah, so sends him on this adventure, this fantasy journey, but as you said, in this unique setting where it's a very familiar world with modern technology, cars, mobile phones, that sort of thing, but still the potential for magic and kind of is largely about how the appreciation of that magic has been lost as people have become fascinated with convenience, technology and convenience. It's working two sides there with the father figure. There's poignancy in the fact that they want a chance for Barley to see his father again and for Ian to meet him for the first time. But because the spell at first only brings back his lower half, there's a lot of comedy there, right? Almost silent film. Like I thought about Charlie Chaplin, how he walks in his movie. They kind of mimic that a little bit with these legs. So it's a really effective balance, I thought, as Pixar manages to do, of moving emotional elements and funny ones. Now, as the brothers go on this journey, they come across this deep chasm at one point, like a huge ravine that they need to cross, but there's no bridge to it. So Ian uses this magical staff to cast a spell that will build they call it a bridge of trust. So this is nothing that he can see that becomes clear to him. It's more if he believes in this magic spell and steps out over the chasm, his foot will land on this invisible support. Let's hear a little bit from that scene.
Ritrigor Invisia!
Hey, you can do this.
With every step. Oh yeah!
You got me, right?
I still got you! Woo-hoo! Ian Lightfoot is fearless!
This is amazing!
Yeah, but just keep going! Don't look back! Just straight ahead!
You still got the rope, right?
Yeah, I got it.
Now, that scene definitely moves in a Peter walking on the water direction because Ian moves further out over the ravine and the situation changes a little bit, we'll just say, without entirely spoiling it. Did that Bible story of Peter walking on the water come to mind for you, Abby? I'm curious how this scene in general resonated for you in terms of Christian notions of trusting and obeying, of having faith, really, which is what's going on here.
Yeah, absolutely. I did think of that story. The other thing that comes to mind almost immediately is the invisible bridge, like the leap of faith scene from Indiana Jones and the Last Crusade, which is almost that same situation, like moment for moment, except that Indy has way more confidence than Ian does. But I love that scene because it actually was one that stuck with me throughout my life, like a thing that would come to mind a lot when I was in the middle of like making a really big decision or unsure that I would be able to accomplish something that I really wanted to, or unsure if I was doing the thing that was right in that moment. And then, yeah, thinking back to the idea of a leap of faith and stepping out on something that you can't see and having to trust that God has your back. And I like that, what Onward kind of does with that scene is that they have like a literal example of like a person trying to support him across that journey. So like the way that works is like Barley is on the side where they start and he's got a rope tied around his brother's waist so that he doesn't have to feel afraid. And then halfway through that rope slips and falls off. But at that point, Ian is still going. And so Barley has a decision to make at that point too, which is almost like a parental decision, really. Like, do I tell him that the support is gone or do I just let him keep going and see what happens? And he chooses to let Ian kind of exercise that faith and trust. And it works out eventually. But yeah, I think it's an interesting moment because it's a moment of faith and trust on both ends, I think, for both of those characters.
Yeah, that's true. And we should say, if we hadn't already, they're voiced by Chris Pratt as Barley and Tom Holland as Ian. And the dynamic in the vocal performances and also the animation, the characterization is really strong. I think this relationship, as the movie goes on, and especially in its climax, comes to be what it's largely about, this brother dynamic. And this scene is a great example of that. It made me think about one of that moment, especially that you mentioned, Abby, with the rope slipping away. One of the key Bible passages about trust, Psalm 31, which reads, "But I trust in you, Lord. I say, you are my God. My times are in your hands." And we might say the rope is in God's hands, even if we can't see it. As you're saying, Abby, when it comes to decisions that you can't foresee what the end result might be, and you're putting trust that this is the right place to go. You know, Christian trust it's not so much about our ability or even you could say really our belief. It's almost more trust is an acknowledgement that God is in control, that God's holding the ropes, the ones that we can see, but also the ones that we can't see, that we just can't imagine that God has his hand on those situations. So I love this scene. It's one of the key ones for the movie, but there's a lot of other good ones. I did like Onward quite a bit. What'd you think of the movie just in general, Abby, to kind of take the scope out and talk about it in general as one of Pixar's installments?
I liked it. I think it's different for them in that I felt throughout the movie that it was maybe one of the first Pixar films that didn't appeal directly to kids, or at least to younger kids. So like the content and the themes in Onward, while there are like a lot of, I think, good in-jokes and things that will appeal to children, I think the way that it tackles single parenthood and the loss of a parent and the weight that that has on a family, I think appeals more strongly to people who have had a little more life experience. And as well as some of the in-jokes, like I know they worked pretty closely with Wizards of the Coast on some of the content, like the gelatinous cube. I think they borrowed directly from Magic the Gathering.
Okay.
And so some of those nerd in-jokes are a little bit more appealing to older people as well. Well,
sure.
I say older people, older adults,
yeah,
like me.
Yeah.
I think that's really interesting. It took me kind of a second to get on board with it because maybe I was at first assuming that it would be a little more kid directed. And so, once I got there though, I think it really started to kick into gear.
Yeah. I think, you know, maybe the only kiddie element is almost that the pet dragon that Ian mm-hmm. and Barley have, but you're right. Otherwise this does, concern itself with more teenagers and even older than that situations people like that might be facing. I mean, in a sense, almost all Pixar's movies are made for parents first. I think that's what's so great about them. And they address parental concerns. They just happen to be kind of cloaked in these kids' stories. But this one maybe is a little bit less of a kid story. That's probably true. Yeah, and I liked, you mentioned the single parenthood thing. I think it gives a lot of time to Barley and Ian's mom, who is voiced by Julia Louis-Dreyfus, and her situation. She gets to be not just a character who shows up at the beginning, but they weave her into their adventure as well, with another supporting character, the Manticore, voiced by Octavia Spencer. I really like their dynamic too. And as I said before, I think this comes to a climax that's incredibly moving, that shouldn't be surprising. Most Pixar films head that way, but I didn't see this one going that way in terms, again, of that relationship between Ian and Barley, how it resolves with their father. And I don't know, maybe this is more for kids, but I liked it too. They do involve a pretty cool dragon at the end, which—
A very cool dragon, yeah.
The animation is inventive. It's kind of taking like, you know, a lot of fantasy stories end with a dragon, but this is the way they bring this one about is really clever, I thought.
Yeah. And another thing that I appreciated about the movie, and you kind of got to this a little bit before, is that another theme of it, in addition to things about grief and parental loss and relationships within a family, is the idea of the magical and the mundane, and how in this world, like, magic does actually exist, but it's become replaced by other things. And so the characters are trying to get back to an idea of like when magic was real and actually had power. And it's slightly different in our world because we don't have like magical spells. But I do think you could apply the same thing to faith and to the kind of the idea of faith as we believe it, which has some inherently supernatural elements to it, which I love. But often kind of gets forgotten in sort of the everyday struggle that we have. So I appreciated the idea of like, what does it look like when we start taking the things that are precious and magical for granted? And
yeah.
How does that, what happens when we forget what that looks like? What does that do to us? And also, I think on the flip side of that, there are a few scenes that actually celebrate the magicalness of mundane experiences. Like there's an entire action set piece that is centered on Ian being able to successfully merge into traffic.
That's true.
which is a small thing, but it's really exciting. And I had this interesting moment where I just thought, like, they're looking at two sides of the same coin, which is like, what happens when we ignore magic in our life and what happens when we embrace even the small things as magical and important?
Yeah. Yeah. And that merging into traffic scene is another example, I think, of it being involved with concerns of maybe an older demographic, right? That's something mm-hmm. that teenagers at Ian's in high school who are learning to drive would definitely resonate with. And to your point about, you know, being willing or having faith to look for the magical, the supernatural, the spiritual in our own world, there's an interesting corollary because it is all around them in these characters still. It's not like magic has been completely forgotten. They just kind of take it for granted, as you said. And similarly, things that, you know, we participate in, whether they're church liturgy, those sorts of things, the church calendar, the way we mark that throughout the year, can become routine and mundane, but there are those moments where they bring back the magic, right? They connect with the spiritual experience that we're looking for. And so in a lot of ways, the movie kind of resonates with that everyday experience we have too. All right, Abby. So a really tough question. I don't think I told you I was going to ask you this, but it kind of comes up naturally whenever a Pixar film is out. But where, I don't know if you've done the endeavor of ranking Pixar films. If you haven't, that's fine. You can just speak generally, but where maybe in particular or in general would you place this among all their other theatrical releases?
Oh, gosh. I think in a way I'm still kind of processing this. And I almost
just
feel
saw it
like
last night, right? So you're
it's
fresh
true.
Off
I did
it.
Just see it last night. And I feel like this is one of those movies that is I think it's I'm going to like it more with time, honestly. There were, I think, a couple of moments watching it where I thought I could see myself rewatching this and really enjoying it for these specific reasons. I would probably place it around the middle at this point. Like the all-time masterpieces, I think, are like Inside Out and WALL-E and Toy Story, I think, are like my big three. But this is still, I mean, a really solid outing. I think it's the second from this director, Dan Scanlon. His first was Monsters University, which I would probably rank a little bit toward the lower end of the pack. But I think it shows really significant growth from him. And it's got a really interesting stable of writers behind it, too. So, yeah, I think it's a good, ambitious kind of middle of the pack release for now, but I could see it kind of growing in my estimation.
Yeah, that seems fair to me. And you're right, Scanlon did do Monsters University, which is not one of my favorites either. I think this is in a different class than that. I probably have, of your favorites, I would say Toy Story is in my top tier. I also put Ratatouille and Finding Nemo up there. But they've got a big top tier. Like WALL-E is right in the conversation. Toy Story 3 up. And yeah, Incredibles and Inside Out, the other one you mentioned, those are all, you know, just completely higher level animated features and among Pixar's best. So I'd probably put Onward somewhere in that second tier where I've got Brave, Monsters, Inc., Incredibles 2, and something like Coco. I'd put it similar to Coco in being this original idea, a different sort of world they're exploring that... Coco also grew on me a little bit, as you're saying, and I could see the same with Onward. But yeah, I would probably put it among the middle of their releases right now. We want to hear what listeners thought about Onward, maybe how listeners would rank it in their Pixar filmography, and maybe also about that Bridge of Trust scene in particular. So if you've seen Onward and want to send us your thoughts, you can send that to tcpodcast@thinkchristian.net. Thanks, Abby, for coming on to talk about Onward. You are very busy. You're heading to not one, but two pop culture festivals in the next couple of weeks. Is that right?
I am. I have a pretty stacked slate. So I'm going to be going to Columbia, Missouri for the True False Film Festival. It's a documentary festival. Probably hanging out with Eric Danielson a little bit while I'm out there.
Fantastic.
Yeah. And then I'll be back home for a few days and then heading out to Austin for South by Southwest. And right after I get back from that, I will be on a panel at KC Comic-Con talking about criticism. So if there are any TC listeners out in the KC area, that may be a good place to find me.
All right. Excellent. Yeah. Those first two fests, True False and South by Southwest, I have not made it to either yet. So I'll be following your adventures, I guess, via social media. Where can listeners keep up with you if they want to get missives from True False or South by Southwest?
Twitter is probably the best place to follow me. I'm just there at Abby Olchesi. I will be writing stuff up for Slash Film and also for Crooked Marquee while I'm at both of those festivals. So if you want to see writing from me that's not in like less than 200 characters, that's where to go.
Sounds good. All right. Thanks again, Abby. Take care.
You too.
Hard to believe it's been 10 years since Lecrae released his breakthrough album Rehab, but it has been. And that was Walking on Water from that epic LP. And it's just one of the cuts from this episode's carefully curated playlist centered on the theme Trust and Obey. It's a pretty fascinating relationship those two things have, isn't it? We can obey for several different reasons in this life. Maybe we believe that obedience will earn us something we want or need. Maybe we obey out of fear. We think the consequences of disobedience would be too harsh to endure. The beauty, though, happens when we obey because we have faith in the one giving us the instructions. We trust. We walk on the water, as it were, until we sink and we reach out for help all over again. It's quite a cycle, and it can make for some great art. Hi, John J. Thompson here, your stalwart collector of songs, and yes, I've done it again. I have pulled together 30 songs for you, all about trusting or not trusting, obeying or not obeying, and some of the things that either build or tear down our trust. It's a fun list with cuts from Need to Breathe, The Black Keys, Eurythmics, Radiohead, Green Day, Stryper, Over the Rhine, Charlie Pride, one of my favorite gospel songs from the Joubert Singers, and a bunch of stuff I bet you have never heard of, and U2's first big U.S. single, and boy, did we follow them after hearing that song 40 years ago. You'll hear a bit of that one a little bit later in this episode. It's easy to follow along, of course. Just search for the Think Christian playlist on Spotify or find the link in the email you get if you're subscribed to the mailing list and hit play. If you follow the latest episode playlist, the newest one will always be there in your browser, but you can also find each episode's batch listed separately under the Think Christian profile. And of course, we combine all of the playlists into one massive archive, so why not follow that one as well? And as always, if you think of any great obey and trust songs I should add, feel free to tweet at me at John J. Thompson, and I will take your suggestion under advisement. Until next time, this is JJT saying, listen, because I said so. I mean, Simon Says. I mean, follow the playlist. I mean, you can trust me. Seriously.
I want to welcome TC Writer, regular podcast guest, and most importantly for this conversation, Texan, J.R. Forresteros. Now, J.R., remind me, you're not a native Texan, right? But you have lived there a while. Do I remember that right?
Yeah, that's right. I grew up in the Midwest and moved to Texas about 5.5 years ago. So I have drunk the Texas Kool-Aid. I have season tickets to the state fair. Like, I've gone full. I've gone in.
There you go. Did you know before the move that cheer, competitive cheer, was such a big part of Texas culture? Because that's something I learned from this Netflix documentary series.
No, of course, all I knew was Friday Night Lights, right? Okay. Like the Texas football, which, yes, you know, obviously in hindsight, it makes sense that cheer and football go together so well. But no, I had no idea that competitive cheer honestly was even that big a deal at the collegiate level, like that, like it features in the documentary. So I, watching it, I learned a ton about the sport of cheerleading and just how big of a deal it is, especially, you know, right down the road from us.
Yeah. Yeah. That was enlightening to me too, and pretty fascinating. So the series is called Just Cheer, and it is a documentary series on Netflix. It follows this competitive cheerleading squad at Navarro College, which is outside Dallas, I think like 40 miles or something like that. And it's a relatively small community college, but has managed to really dominate over the last couple of years the national championships. And they've done that under this head coach, Monica Aldama. Maybe we can start there, JR, because she was such a compelling figure to me, Monica Aldama, partly because I got the sense she was very proud of the program and sort of wanted to talk about it, but in a way, sort of wished the cameras weren't there. I got this sense. So she kind of fascinated me. What did you make of her?
Yeah, you know, to find out from the documentary that she almost completely created this program from scratch, you know, came to this junior college where there was the bare bones of a competitive cheer team and built a multiple national championship team that now has like an amazing reputation, and did it in such a way that she walked such a fine line of that sort of whiplash coach, where it's I don't care how bad it hurts, I don't care what it does to your body, like win at all costs, but then also showed what seemed to me to be genuine concern for the lives of these students, and was, I think, in a way very rightfully proud of the space she provided for a lot of these kids who came from backgrounds where they didn't receive a lot of love and support and were able to find that in the cheer family, and understood that that was the culture that she created, you know? So it was such a strange tension to see those two things. And then, yeah, to your point, right? Especially when the chips were down when an athlete fell and hurt themselves. And then there were those really tough questions of, is this routine just too hard? Are we going to make it? Is it okay for me to push them even though they're tired and hurting and all of that? Yeah, I really did get the sense that she was like behaving differently because the cameras were on her.
Yeah. There's definitely a tension. The word you use is accurate in watching her. And that's why she is so compelling, I think. And she also, for me, she was kind of a flashpoint for, she was kind of a flashpoint for this idea of trust that we're exploring in this episode, because it seemed to me there are two levels of trust going on with the dynamic of this team. You've got the trust among the athletes, which is what first drew me to this series. I thought it'd be interesting to see a documentary explore that. So the trust that they're going to catch each other, right? When they get thrown so high into the air, and also the trust that they're going to put in the work and the commitment to be able to catch each other. Because that's a question too, with some of these students. And I think this is a fairly human common understanding of trust. You know, I trust you, you trust me, we're working towards something together, we're in something together. But Monica Aldama represents, she brings up bigger questions of trust. And in one way, as you said, she could potentially be more of a model of the athletes putting trust in her the way we put our trust in God. You mentioned the caring aspect, and you definitely see evidence of that. Some of these kids who have come from difficult situations find that community you mentioned, and she has fostered it. So there's that aspect. And she also maybe echoes our trust in God because she is more powerful than these athletes. She's more knowledgeable, right, about the sport. She knows what it takes to win. She has the track record at this point. And a fair number of these kids, some of them are, you know, relatively new to cheer. And yeah, she has that aspect of caring about them as people too. But there's a crucial distinction, it struck me, in watching this series unfold. Monica Aldama still needs something from the people who trust her. And you mentioned it, right? At the end of the day, she needs their performance. She needs them to be able to pull off these techniques that they've designed. And that's where the breakdown comes, because God needs nothing from us. You know, we place our trust in him, but it's not a quid pro quo thing where he's looking to get something out of it. And he's just offering that love, you know, a variation of the love we see Aldama offering, but not exchanged for anything. And I think you're right. You mentioned that injury montage. It's really a montage, because during one practice session, I think it's episode three, maybe three, possibly four people are either dropped or have some sort of injury in a row. And that's when those questions really come up. What are her priority is going to be? And it's, you know, it's not just her or this sport. It's really a question of any coach in any sport. When someone is hurt, how far are you going to push them? How far are you going to protect their injury? And I thought that episode kind of revealed both the way their trust in her modeled our trust in God, but also where it breaks down.
Yeah. And, you know, I think a really important distinction that struck me as I was watching, especially those early episodes that are still sort of teaching me, the viewer, about the world of competitive cheer, is that competitive cheer evolved from sidelines cheerleading.
Mm-hmm.
You know, there wasn't, it's not like, you know, it's not like the sport was invented out of whole cloth one day. And so the pyramids, the jumps, the tosses, all of those things have grown gradually. And one of the things that Monica says early in the series is that every year you have to do more than you did the year before, because whoever won, everyone else is now going to be copying what they did last year. So if you won, you have to be doing something more, a higher pyramid, bigger tosses, a more complicated thing. And at one point she made the comment, you know, we don't know what the limit of what's possible is.
Mm-hmm. Yeah.
And so I had the thought, what happens, like at some point they will peak. You know, at some point it will, and I feel like they're already pretty close to that, because she even said, you know, the performances at this point are more who messes up than who achieves something that no one's ever seen before. You know,
yeah.
The pyramids can only get so high. The tosses can only get so high. The dance routines can only get so complex with the number of cheerleaders allowed on the mat, right? On mat. And so I think a crucial distinction between the kind of trust that the athletes are putting in Monica and the kind of trust that we're able to put in God is that it's very possible that in the documentary we watched, and certainly in future seasons, that she would be asking them to do things that that are truly beyond their capability to achieve. And she would not know that, right?
Yeah.
You can't know that until you, humans can't know that until we try it and fail. I think the difference is when we see what God calls us to do, both through scripture and in our own private practices and things like that, when we know that God has called us to something, we can have confidence that it's something that we can achieve because the one who calls us also empowers and equips us through the Holy Spirit to accomplish those things. And so I think we have a different kind of anxiety approaching our vocation and our calling from God than what we see in the documentary, where, again, humans are really pushing the limits of what it's possible for us to, and we might not know.
Yeah, so it comes back to the motivation factor, too, in asking for that trust. Is it purely out of love, which is what we understand is coming from God, or do other motives, understandably in some ways, at the human level, come into play, which we do see here. And yeah, you're so right about the fact that escalation is kind of built into this sport, you know, because there are some guidelines and some rules, but it is always evolving. And that's part of the challenge too. So we spend a lot of time on Monica Aldama, but what about these athletes? Did you have a favorite team member who kind of, because one of the things that disappointed me a little bit about the series was the structure. I feel like they took on so much and one episode would kind of be scattered where we'd just be getting into one athlete's home life or background, and then they jump over to something else. And the structure was a little unwieldy, but I do have a favorite. I'll see who you maybe found more interesting among the athletes.
I think my favorite was probably Lexi Brumback.
Okay.
I was really compelled by her movement from outsider to insider, which largely happened inside of her own spirit, right? I mean, they welcomed her pretty immediately with open arms, but in those early episodes, she was talking about how she didn't trust people. She had always been used to being a loner and watching out for herself. And I think the incident in the later part of the documentary where some of her what do we say? Intimate photos from when she was in high school got leaked by someone that, you know, had it out for her. And she, her fear, and again, you want to talk about another great example of God's love and mercy towards us. Her great fear was that when she tells Monica, Monica is going to be concerned not about Lexi herself, but about how this is going to affect the team and the image. Because again, that was made a point that Monica wants a certain look, Monica wants a certain image, that because cheerleaders kind of evolved out of that like 1950s high school, you know, homecoming queen sort of a thing, there is a like a image that Lexi does not fit in her personal life and in her high school life. But yet, when she finally breaks down and confesses to Monica what's going on, Monica, at least not that they showed in the documentary and not that Lexi processes, not for one second blamed Lexi in any way. And Lexi even said, like, from the get-go, she treated me as a victim of this. And you hear Monica talking about that with the police, and Monica's with her every step of the way. And again, I think that so often when we think about approaching God with our sinfulness, we think about receiving judgment and condemnation and that, but what we find is God's grace and mercy towards us, God's readiness to forgive us and to help us to repent and to seek the good. And so I shared some of Lexi's anxiety as she was going to Monica, because I think they paint Monica as a complex enough coach that I thought and hoped that she would probably be on Lexi's side, but I understood Lexi's concern. And it was, honestly, that was probably my favorite part of the documentary. And then after that, the way Lexi let herself be included and let herself receive the love and care of the cheer group, which again, I think I see that kind of pattern so much in the church, when people finally recognize that God loves them and is gracious and merciful towards them, it allows them to then love other people and to receive other people's love.
Yeah, to see her response to that, definitely. And Lexi, if I'm remembering right, she was one who came, she was relatively new to cheer. I mean, incredibly naturally talented at it, but maybe not as much, because some of these students have, you know, been cheering since they were, what, like 4 or 5 or something like that. But she's one of the more newcomers, and she's definitely, you know, has a very interesting story and background. The guy who I couldn't help rooting for along with Lexi, though, was Jerry Harris. And it speaks to your point about not fitting the type, right? I mean, they have these, am I using the right word, stunters? Was he a stunter?
Yeah,
who basically support the athletes who are up at the top of the pyramid. And so most of these are pretty, like, buff, muscle-bound guys, and Jerry is on the heavier side. He's a big guy, but he's not quite as cut. And he talks about this, and he talks about, you know, this is a kid who's liked cheer for most of his life. He's been at it a long time. And there's a push and pull. There's that tension there with Monica, too, where she recognizes that he doesn't have that quote-unquote look, but he has the enthusiasm, he has the commitment, and just circling back to the idea of trust, like, you get a sense just as a viewer, if I had to put my trust in anyone on that team, as another athlete, it would be Jerry, you know, because you just feel like he was coming at this with love. And he was not necessarily, even when he did get cut from the mat at one point in favor of someone else, the way he handled it reveals that he's coming at this experience with love first. And I think that just enables others to trust him more.
I mean, honestly, those were the relationships that I found the most compelling in watching the documentary. I mean, you know, a lot of these sports documentaries rely on the drama of will they or won't they. Sometimes especially in team sports, and it overshadows the relationships on the teams. But honestly, I found the relationships between the teammates and among the team themselves to be, like I said, just really compelling. And, you know, I think I was telling you this before the recording, going into the film or the documentary, I was expecting the team dynamic to be way more cutthroat and backstabby, especially after that first episode established the stakes for Navarro. And it was beautiful to see this mix of athletes who were, on one hand, deeply committed to working as hard as they had to get on mat, but then equally deeply committed to celebrating each other, to celebrating the people who did make it on mat, even when they didn't. You know, in the midst of their own grief about making it on mat, that didn't prevent them from being excited for their teammates. And I think that's honestly more rare, especially in the competitive sports world that we have today. And I think it speaks to the culture that Monica has built. And I mean, honestly, probably why they're such a championship team. That she's really built a dynasty that's founded on more than just athletic excellence.
Yeah, probably. So there's a lot going on in Cheer. I think you're right. It surprised me with the layers and the complexities that it does explore. And I think the episodic nature of it helps to overcome that dynamic you're talking about, where it's all, they do have the countdown to the national championships that we're following, but by having these other episodes, it allows us to go in other directions here and there. Maybe my favorite thing about it, though, I have to throw in real quick, is that opening title, where it's just Cheer as they're forming a pyramid, but they have it. It's like 3D, so that some of them are in the lines of the letters. Yeah, so Netflix, they get their title sequences down pretty well. We want to hear if listeners have been following along with Cheer. What'd you make of it? Let us know by emailing us at tcpodcast@thinkchristian.net. Yet, JR, you mentioned you're not too far away from Navarro. Are you going to, you know, make a trip to see the squad live anytime soon?
It would be so cool to head down there. I mean, it's, you know, maybe an hour, probably a little less than an hour from us, depending on traffic. And I know, you know, even the documentary, they showed that they do home performances in their, you know, at Corsicana. So I think it would be so fun to go check it out.
Well, if you do that, let us know. Let us know how it goes and what you see.
Yeah. I mean, if I go, I'll definitely live stream it, obviously.
There you go. Excellent. All right. Thanks so much, JR. We'll talk to you again down the road.
Oh, thank you, Josh. It's always a pleasure.
That was a bit of I Will Follow, an early U2 song and one of my favorites. What does it take to follow? A lot of trust, which a lot of times comes down to one question. Do we believe that God knows better than us? Now, that's a hard step, a hard leap to take, even though we have the evidence of the Old Testament that God is faithful throughout generations. It should be easy enough for us to take that step with that in mind. More songs about trust can be found on the Spotify playlist that John J. Thompson compiled for this episode. Just search for the Think Christian playlist on Spotify to find that. Thanks, John, for compiling that list, and thanks to J.R. Forresteros and Abby Olchesi for joining me to talk about Cheer and Onward. If you want to find them on Twitter, they're at Abby Olchesi and at J.R. Forresteros, easy enough. If you want to look for me on Twitter, I'm at Larson on Film, and of course, we're also there as Think Christian. Now, before we wrap up, I wanted to share some feedback that we've gotten about our last episode. That was our massive best of the 2010 shows, where we considered the pop culture that we thought captured the spiritual mood of that decade. Again, any feedback you can send to tcpodcast@thinkchristian.net. We heard from Josh Coldajelli. He's on Twitter as J_coldasjelly, and here's what he offered. I think Julian Baker's music, the solo work plus Boy Genius from the second half of the decade, captures the essence of many in spiritual boxing matches throughout the 2010s. We also heard from Brian Daniel on Twitter as BC Daniel. He threw in Interstellar, saying, confronting the equations that we have always lived with and maybe the sense that there's more than the math that can be trusted. Thanks, Brian. I will keep your thoughts in mind when I see Interstellar again in about a week or so at the Music Box's 70mm Film Festival. I probably underrated that Christopher Nolan film, your idea there, and the 70mm might change my mind on it. One more bit of feedback here from Diana Anderson. She shared this on Facebook. Snowpiercer and Parasite as bookends of the decade's reshaping and cynicism. So she's throwing in two Bong Joon-ho films in the mix. Diane also said, Sorry to Bother You is a good middle point between them as well. Thank you all for sharing that. And if anyone else wants to share feedback, you can follow us on Facebook and Twitter at Think Christian, or use that email address, tcpodcast@thinkchristian.net. Our next episode, we're going to be talking about idols. And to help us do that, we'll take a look at Taylor Swift's documentary, Miss Americana, and the new Grimes album, Miss Anthropocene. So look for that in a couple of weeks. The Think Christian podcast is a production of Reframe Media, a family of programs designed to help you see your whole life reframed by God's gospel story. Visit reframemedia.com for more info. Our audio engineer and post-production supervisor is John Reeder, and Reframe's co-director overseeing content strategy is Robin Basselin. Thanks so much for listening. We'll get together again soon to consider how another aspect of our pop culture fandom connects with our faith.